Good evening, everyone. I'm really delighted to be able to present Carolyn Woods and her new novel, The Lunar Housewife, to you. Last week, when we had it scheduled, a tornado intervened. So, Carolyn, before we talk about your book, what was that like?
It was a little scary. I have two kids, 7 and 4, two little girls. And right in the middle of their dinner, we went down into the basement and kind of crouched. And I didn't know if that at that point, if I was being overly cautious, but, you know, all the lights went out. And then it was very loud, dark. We heard that sound like a train. I don't know if they ever confirmed that an actual tornado came through here, but I know it was a supercell thunderstorm. And then after it was over, we went outside and there were huge trees down all over our town. So, you know, everyone came out and it was kind of eerie, like the light was orange and no one had power. So it was quite an experience, but I think it came on really fast. At about 7:20 that evening, I was still thinking I was doing the event. And then realized we had no electricity or internet, and neither did any of our neighbors. So there was nowhere to go. So I'm very sorry that I had to reschedule.
Oh, no, you don't have to be sorry at all. It wasn't a problem to reschedule. But I was thinking, because there's so many World War II stories that we have been doing. There's this, you know, absolute tidal wave of World War II women's stories. And, you know, many of them involve living through the Blitz. And I thought to myself that your experience might not have been, I mean, was undoubtedly similar to, you know, people in London who had to dive down into their bomb shelters and basements to escape bombs. In your case, it's a tornado. What suburb of Chicago are you in?
We're in Riverside, which is a western suburb. It's just west of Berwyn, so okay. Kind of south of Oak Park and River Forest. Yeah.
So it's more likely, yeah, the western suburbs are more likely to catch it. I grew up in Winnetka, which is north of Chicago, directly on Lake Michigan.
And you went to New Trier?
I did go to New Trier. Indeed, I did, which was at that time considered the best high school in the United States. It was a remarkable, really remarkable school. We had a great education. I feel very fortunate to have gone through the whole Winnetka school system. There were many people who came to study at Crow Island School, which was the elementary school, and then Skokie Junior High. And at that time, New Trier had not yet had to build a second campus, which it did. So there was New Trier West arrived after I left because of the huge growth of children born after the war, you know, that whole baby boom thing. I'm not sure whether it survives today, does it? Do you know?
I'm not sure about the buildings, but I mean, obviously, New Trier itself is still...
No, I'm at New Trier West. I'm not sure that the expansion has been, you know, its population has contracted. I haven't really paid attention. But anyway, I was a teenager. Actually, I was a junior high school, elementary school, junior high school, in the period that Carolyn's book is set. So it was fun for me to read The Lunar Housewife and recognize, it's scary, Carolyn, when your life turns into history.
Right. Well, it's funny that you mentioned people hiding in the Blitz, because I was thinking about, there is a scene in The Lunar Housewife where Louise and her friend Harry go into a nuclear fallout shelter. And I wanted to put that in because everything I read, any book written in that time, there's always a mention of people's fear of nuclear war and the Soviets in the early 50s.
That's right.
So I thought I have to put in something.
We were actually drilled to hide under our desks at school. You know, I mean, it was a very real thing. People had survival kits, water and canned food and all the rest of it. And it was very much a carryover sort of the Blitz. But the Cold War, it really peaked, you know, with Kennedy and the whole Bay of Pigs thing. And at that point, everybody made what we thought was a kind of gentleman's agreement. But here we are, you know, dodging around Putin and the threat of nuclear war or North Korea. And, you know, who knows whether somebody may touch it off, in which case we all know that living in your basement isn't really going to help you.
No, absolutely not. Yeah, I think it, a lot of the tension that we think of, or that we thought, I think, was done when the Berlin Wall fell, is obviously has just been simmering, and a lot of the same threats of the 1950s are still a concern today, unfortunately.
Well, the 1930s was a time when all, you know, totalitarian autocrats rose, because for a whole lot of factors, and what we're seeing is a whole renaissance. So that I've said this often, I used to congratulate myself that I was born in 1940, so I really missed the 30s. And I was a child during the war, so I don't remember a lot of it, but I never did expect at the end of my life that I would suddenly, you know, be back in the 1930s, only a more modern version. But anyway, we're here to talk about The Lunar Housewife, Carolyn's new novel, and our previous novel called Fräulein M. Was a great success and has been published. I thought this was interesting. It was released in England as The Cigarette Girl, and in the Czech, well, I don't have to go into the Czech Republic, but why do you think the British retitled it The Cigarette Girl? I think that's fascinating.
They said it was a marketing decision. I don't know. There are so many titles with the word girl in them, and there must be some, they say psychological reason why people are going to pick up a book that says girl. I know. I thought that was fascinating too. And they put a blonde woman on the cover, which the main character has dark brown hair. But I loved the cover anyway. It was really interesting. They said, we want to publish it, but we want to publish it as The Cigarette Girl.
You know what? Every publisher should know its own market, right?
That's right.
And that's why cover art and titles, readers don't often realize that authors have no control over titles or cover art, the packaging of the book. The author owns a copyright to the work, to the content, to the story, but the publishers own the rest of it, and they can do whatever they want. And generally, it is the sales department or the marketing department that makes those decisions based on their data or what they, you know, what they think is going to work. So,
but yeah, and I think I trust them because I don't have that kind of background. And I think, okay, well, you know, you must have learned about this in school and I didn't, and I would listen to you.
Well, you know, it isn't even a question of choice. That's your contract. So whether you trust them or not really doesn't matter. They get to do it. But I do find, why did you choose to write a book set in the 1950s and largely in the area in which you live?
Well, I had done, Fräulein M is about the 30s in Berlin. It's not really about World War II. It's the lead up to World War II. But I didn't want to go there because I had done that already. But I like mid-century. I like 20th century historical fiction a lot. Yeah. And I knew I wanted to write about the CIA and its involvement in American art and literature and, you know, role in propagandizing and sometimes censoring American artists. So I could have written about any period in the Cold War, because from what I understand, they had a hand in art, music, literature the whole time. But I thought that the early Cold War was really interesting, partly because I don't know why this detail caught my attention, but a lot of the men, and I think they were mostly men who were recruited into the early CIA, were recruited right out of college. And they were brought in by their professors at Harvard and Yale in the American Studies departments. And that just seemed like such an interesting dynamic, you know, like these guys are essentially fresh out of their teenage years, and they're being pulled into this mysterious and kind of exciting new branch of government that no one really quite knew what they were going to do yet. And I decided to start the story there. And then of course, one of the first bits of history that you hear about when you look into the CIA's involvement with literature is the Paris Review. And they were founded in Paris in the late 40s as a cover for Peter Matheson's activities as a spy. The magazine was purely a front at first. And now, and the fact that that magazine survives today and is so prestigious and has been for so long, I thought it was a good jumping off point for the story.
It is fascinating. Actually, spies, you know, that was the same thing going on in Britain, had recruited spies from Cambridge particularly, but also Oxford, and the same kind of, you know, professor. And there was a kind of a thing, I think, about, you know, these educated men from higher levels of society would make the best intelligence agents. I misspoke, because actually this book starts in 1953 in New York, not Chicago. I'm in an urban area here, but you know, New York was at that point, you know, and to some degree still is, kind of the epicenter of American arts, American literature, wouldn't you say? More so, maybe today, San Francisco and other places have you know, earned equal rights, but certainly in the 50s, I think New York was such a powerhouse.
I think so too, and I lived in New York too, so a lot of the book is taken straight out of my life. Like Louise's apartment with the tiny bedroom is like one that I lived in my 20s. She eats at Keen's Steakhouse, where I used to eat all the time at my old job. So it's personal for me too, to write about New York. And probably next I'll go to either Boston or Chicago, because I've lived there since I lived in New York. But yeah, I mean, New York had a real hold on what was probably considered highbrow American culture at the time. So you could see that it was, according to some sources that I found, it was crawling with spies in every newspaper and publishing house. Some people think because they, meaning the CIA, the government, really wanted to make sure that whatever op-eds and essays and articles were going out there were painting the U.S. in a favorable light. And there are some stories of, or some stories now of like articles being killed because, say, they were too sympathetic to China or something like that.
So this is also, you know, the, when did McCarthy really start having his greatest impact? It was, he was certainly in play in 1953 because it peaked about 1960, 59 or 60, you know, but you know, the background of McCarthy and the Red Scare and the censorship and people losing their jobs and, you know, going to prison or peaching on other people was so severe. But was it that severe in New York? Do you think New York had a certain insulation from it?
I think it may, well, there may have been a softer side, like a more persuasion rather than threat was used to get people to write what they wanted them to write. However, I think any writer could have been called before Joe McCarthy's Senate committee. And I, in my research for the book, uncovered the transcript of Langston Hughes's closed door Senate testimony, which none of the characters in the book would have been aware of, or they might have been aware that he testified, but they wouldn't have been able to read it. And we can read it now because of the Freedom of Information Act. But it was fascinating because they, you know, and awful, because they're grilling Langston Hughes, and he's making a case for what's in his poetry. And they're asking, you know, have you ever been to the Soviet Union? Do you speak Russian? Do you consider yourself a communist? Like, they won't let it go, these senators. And at one point they even come right out and say to him, we are asking these questions because we put American books in libraries overseas, and we propagandize, they use the word propagandize, American art, and we want to know if yours is worthy of inclusion. And we can't have, you know, people who are communists leading included in these collections. And I thought, wow, you know, this, they're just saying it in this Senate hearing, but I couldn't include it in the book because Louise wouldn't have been able to read it.
Well, you know, the rise of communism was really terrifying to people. And although they were briefly our allies in the war, you know, the Cold War really, the Iron Curtain really slammed down. I think it was, what, 47 or something like that. And everybody was absolutely terrified of it. I mean, there's an echo of it today. You know, we're all scared to death of Putin because he has nuclear. But back then, it was much more ideological. I don't think that communism has the ideological hold that that it had then. If you look at the Spanish Civil War, which was, you know, a tremendous battle between communism and fascism and so forth, and, you know, really, it reminds me of the religious wars in like the 30 Years' War in the 1600s or something, the Catholics and the Protestants, and nobody was going to give ground, and they were all ideologues and whatever. And if you look at the Spanish Civil War, or if you look at Germany after, you know, East Germany versus West Germany, it's interesting, Carolyn, that we're suddenly getting from two of our best spy novelists, Joseph Cannon and Dan Vesperman. Both have a book out this year. I'm putting them together actually on July 11th. What happened when the wall came down, or before it? What was the Stasi Germany like? Because we haven't had access to enough information about it for writers to really dig into it until fairly recently. But I think, you know, we kind of moved from wartime Berlin or 1930s Berlin. All of a sudden, you know, now we're looking at Berlin under the Stasi's, Stasi regime. So, you know, and here we have right in our own home, you know, we have the big lie versus, you know, my husband is, and I just could hardly believe the Republican Party has actually made that part of their platform today, you know, that the election was stolen and that Trump didn't really lose it. And I think every possible investigation into the election has not confirmed that, and yet they're actually going to go with that as a piece of party propaganda. I'm just shocked.
No, and if you dare to speak against it, like Liz Cheney is doing, you're committing political suicide, which is incredible and scary.
She's a very brave woman, and you know, when history looks back at all of this, you know, she's going to be the Abe Lincoln of this era rather than. She really is, you know.
I've thought about that a lot too, because as I was researching Fräulein M, I was reading a lot of speeches, articles that were written pre-1933 in Germany. And there are people who went on record saying, you know, warning other people about what was coming. And, you know, this is a very different situation, but she is clearly trying to put her voice on the record that so that she will end up on the right side of history.
Very true. Well, let's go back to New York in 1953. So this is a novel, not you know, historical narrative. So tell us about who your main characters are, what's going on.
Sure. So the protagonist is Louise Lighthouser, who is by day a law clerk, but she's an aspiring writer, and she has written some pieces under a male pseudonym for a fictional magazine called Downtown, which is co-run by her boyfriend and is kind of a combination of the Paris Review and Playboy or Esquire. And then she gets her big break, which is interviewing Ernest Hemingway for Downtown, at the same time that she's starting to suspect that somebody else could be pulling the strings at this magazine. She hears her boyfriend and his partner arguing about a mysterious figure who could be listening to them and the possibility that they'll be killed for saying something out of line, and the story takes off from there. So it's kind of a David and Goliath story. She can't trust anyone. I don't think I've said this in an interview yet, but I was partly inspired by Rosemary's Baby and the sense that the walls are closing in and, you know, Rosemary finds people she can trust and that she can't. So it's a conspiracy book, but at the same time, Louise is writing her own novel on the side, which is called The Lunar Housewife. And it's a sci-fi romance between an American woman and a Soviet man, because I thought she should be writing the thing that the CIA handlers would hate the most. Pieces of that interspersed into the main narrative. It's not a full novel within a novel, but it's, you know, there's a little chapter here and there, and you get to see the story build as these two people live in a lunar colony with each other and, you know, sparks fly. And so it ends up also being about not only how Louise can save herself and figure out what's going on, but how can she save the integrity of her own art?
Right. I love the Lunar Housewife. You know, this was before we got to the moon, before there was a moonshot. So in fact, science fiction today, you know, you'd be in some galaxy far, far away. But in the 1953, the idea of actually reaching the moon or exploring it was, you know, pretty exotic. So I thought you scaled that down very nicely.
Oh, good. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, the moon was the goal of NASA and the Soviet space program. So that's another thing that would make her book really subversive, because it would presuppose that the Soviets win the space race, essentially, in her version. And I don't necessarily think she is pro-Soviet, but she is pro being able to write what she wants. So that those parts were really fun to write, because I'm supposed to be writing as Louise in those parts. So I could make the romance kind of steamy and kitschy and use a lot of 1950s gadgety words, you know. My publisher even encouraged me to dial that up. They were like, make this, you know, fun and retro. And I looked at old sci-fi magazines and art from the time and really just tried to get that flavor. And that was a great time.
So that's how you developed Louise's voice. I was going to ask you that question because, you know, it needs to be, you're so close in time in some ways to where we are today. I mean, it's not like you're writing, you know, medieval romance or Victorian fiction, but at the same time, you do need to have a voice that's true to 1953. You don't want it to be today, you know, just retro. So how did you go about creating Louise's voice?
To create Louise's voice and dialogue and in the narration, because it's in the main part of the book is in first person, I did things like, I read articles and stories written by women in that time, but I also watched Hitchcock movies and listen to the way Grace Kelly spoke, which it's, there's a combination of, you know, great intelligence and insight and also the kind of childlike wonder style that was popular at the time. And sometimes I had Louise speak that way, maybe more when she's with her boyfriend and less when she's with another woman. I also have an old copy of Glamour from 1954, and that helps you get into the mindset. And Louise even mentions Glamour in the novel and says that she's kind of tired of reading it because it's all China patterns and silver ads and that kind of thing.
Lord, we had the Ladies Home Journal, we had Good Housekeeping, we had Life if you wanted photos, we had Time. You know, it the 50s was a tremendous, maybe the late 40s too. Magazines were so powerful.
It was a great time for magazines. I used to work at Redbook.
Okay.
I know that it was not that way anymore. The 50s and they were beautiful. I mean, the glamour that I have is big and glossy and it has great, beautiful ads. The ads were more informative than the articles because,
well, but you know, they were like Instagram. I mean, they were made people read them aspirational, you know. It could be photo play for Gossip, or I'm trying to remember the big Gossip, you know, screen, wasn't there a screen, something, the Hollywood stuff, you know, so you could sort of like dish the dirt.
Oh, Cadler, but, and
but if you looked at you know, things like Glamour and all, it was very much designed to make the ordinary person, you know, aspire to the, you know, the clothes and the models and the lifestyle and the whole bit. And I think it was very much like Instagram. But it's nice that they're preserved, and so that you can go back, as you say, and you can read them. I know a lot of historical novelists find that the best way to research a period is to look at, if it's contemporary enough, to look at newspaper ads and that kind of, or magazines and so forth, and see what kind of products, you know, if you're back in the guild, you could look for Lily Langtry and soap if you wanted to write about, you know, the Edwardian age and so forth. So I can see that magazines would have been a lot of fun for you to troll through.
They were very helpful. And I also read and was really inspired by Anne Royfe's memoir, which is Art and Madness. She wrote it later, but it was about being a single mother in New York in the early 60s. But she was a frequent guest at George Plimpton's parties, mm-hmm. the Upper East Side. So she had so much material in her book about what it was like to be at those parties and rubbing elbows with New York's elite, and not just literary elite, but people like Jackie Kennedy were at Plimpton's parties. And she was also an aspiring writer while she was there. So that really gave me some insight into the kind of young women who would have been at these Paris Review type parties and what they would have been thinking. And I got the sense that that a lot of them were there in the hope that they would slip into a conversation and get noticed by an editor or a publisher or, you know, someone who could give them an assignment. They weren't bimbos on the couches, as I think they're sometimes portrayed. So that was another really good research item that I came across.
Sure. That sort of thing still goes on today with writers' conferences, or, yeah. you know, you could go to Thriller Fest, which is the International Thriller Writers Association, actually has a pitch fest and a craft fest as well. But the pitch fest is there so that people can try to hook up basically with, you know, an editor or an agent or something and get noticed. Because if you are a writer, finding that channel towards publication is, you know, what you aspire to.
Right.
So there she is. You must have had a lot of fun figuring out what interviewing these famous people like Ernest Hemingway would actually have been like. How did you decide which people would be on her radar?
Hemingway I knew right from the beginning, because he seemed very aware of the presence of surveillance, the FBI in his life. He seemed he told friends, he wrote letters saying, you know, I have to get out of here because they're listening to me, and they probably were. And he gave that as his reason for moving to Cuba. So I thought that Hemingway would be a believable ally for Louise if she's starting to uncover this kind of surveillance. He had also given interviews to young women at the time. Lillian Ross basically made her career on interviewing Hemingway when she was only 32. And she wrote a great kind of madcap interview with Hemingway that was published in the New Yorker in, I think, 50 or 51. And he takes her to the plaza, they go buy him a coat at Abercrombie. And a lot of people didn't, apparently it was a controversial interview at the time because it presented Hemingway in a kind of a comical light. He comes across as a little bit goofy, but, you know, also brilliant at the same time. And I think it was unpopular, but Hemingway himself liked it and became friends with Lillian Ross, gave her another interview before he died. So he seemed an interesting counterpoint to a lot of the sexism that Louise faces. I mean, my Hemingway certainly says a couple of things that you would not be able to say today and shouldn't. But I thought he serves this kind of godfather role to Louise in this book. And I thought, this is conceivable that he would take her under his wing and enjoy this time with this cub reporter, as he calls her, and allow her this big break. And then James Baldwin I chose for a similar reason, which is that the CIA was watching him too. And he was an early partner in the Paris Review and was edged out of his role there. And some people think that's probably because the CIA was setting up this magazine for Matheson to use as his cover, paying for the Paris apartment, and probably wouldn't have loved Baldwin being involved, because that's, you know, one of the most consequential sides of this whole thing is that targets were often Black writers who the government didn't want saying anything too critical about the U.S. abroad. And that's exactly, you know, Baldwin's living in Paris and writing about Jim Crow. And so I thought I would include Baldwin, and really wanted to kind of let my Baldwin character speak for himself. So I have him talk about Stranger in the Village, which came out in Harper's in the summer of 53 or the fall. It came out in 53. And he kind of summarizes what it's about. And I was hoping that people who read the book go read the essay, because it's, you know, wonderful. But he seemed like another figure that was natural to include, because he really did live this writer under the CIA eye experience.
So we've talked about Louise, but define what her goals are. Who is Louise and what is she trying to accomplish? It's more than one thing here.
Yeah, Louise is hiding a lot about her past. She feels unsophisticated and kind of intimidated by these Ivy League people who she's fallen in with. And it's a little, I guess it's revealed in the first chapter that she came to the first party at Harry's house, or Harry's apartment, and he's based on like a Plimpton type character, as a waitress, and ditched her apron and shimmied in there and became the girlfriend of this Harvard guy, the founder of the magazine, and never even told him that she was a waitress. So she wants to become a writer, and she's kind of a pragmatist, because she says, I'm writing a romance because that's what you write if you're a girl, as they're all known as girls. You write for the girls. And as one of the editors points out to her, like, oh yeah, those things, they sell like hotcakes. I think romance was just catching on here in the 50s, but it had already become popular in the UK.
You know, there was, I'm trying to remember, the company Harlequin was the big romance house here, and it will come to me, but there was a counterpoint UK publisher that, and if you even said the name, everybody knew what it was.
I think the name is in the book and it's escaping me at the moment. Of course, I'll remember it later. But yeah, so she says she's writing because she wants to be independent. She does not want to have to marry to find success and independence, although she's in love with Joe.
Right.
Who is the magazine founder. So that's what she wants. She wants to kind of transcend her past and have her mug on a book jacket, as she says. And of course I could relate to that.
I'm looking up British romance publishers. The reason I'm looking down at my phone here, because I think I should be able to find them. It's just so irritating.
Is it Mills and Boone?
Thank you, Patrick. Oh, yeah, that's Mills it. Mills and Boone, exactly. I mean, if you, in that, you know, you said Mills and Boone and immediately everybody knew mm-hmm. the whole deal, just as when you said Harlequin, you know, and there are some contemporary writers today that in crime fiction that got their start. Tess Gerritsen, for example, who's a doctor and who writes, you know, very successful dark crime, got her start writing romance for Harlequin. So it was a place where women could be heard. But, you know, if Louise was in love with Joe, what, you know, there was not the sexual freedom in the 1950s. We didn't have contraception that was reliable. There, you know, there was no pill. And abortion was still illegal. And so, you know, that was a thing you had to think about. If you wanted to have a successful career as a woman, you had to consider the role of pregnancy, whether, you know, planned or unwanted. You know, does Louise deal with that?
Louise does deal with that. So she becomes pregnant in the book, which felt a little like a plot device, but as you just pointed out, was so likely if you were living a modern life like Ezra is. She's dating Joe and considers herself pretty modern because they sleep together. And she becomes pregnant, and it's, she does not see it as, because of who Louise is, she doesn't see it as a ticket to marriage or anything like that. It's not really what she wants. She's afraid that it'll take romance out of things, or that she'll never be able to write again. So she's pregnant for most of the book, and then she writes it into the Lunar Housewife as well.
She what?
She writes that into her novel as well. Oh. That her character also becomes pregnant.
Well, it took, you know, a bit of consequences if you were, you know, sexually active in the 1950s. It really was a different world once we got to the pill and other stuff. So the connection is unstable. I frozen?
You were, no. For a second. I wasn't sure if it was mine.
Sorry.
I think I can hear you.
No,
now.
It's me. Right. Well, if I do, just carry on, because it'll come back. There's so many things to write about in the 50s. So, you know, in many ways, it's just so distant from us. And in many ways, it's really not that far away. So did you find, as you were writing it all, how did that affect your leading your contemporary life in like 2021?
Oh, well, you know, sexism has become less overt now, but I could certainly relate to the conversations that Louise has with groups of men in the Lunar Housewife, where she feels as if they're not really listening to her, or they're talking over her, or they're dismissing her. You know, I think most of us still experience that in 2022. The other piece of the book that is very 2020 in a sense is that I wrote almost all of it in the spring of 2020, right after we all went into lockdown. And it was, as a writing experience, a very concentrated time. And I think feeling as if we didn't have anything else going on, in a sense, helped me develop more of a daily writing habit than I had had before. Not that I'm saying it was a good thing that COVID-19 hit us, but it also informed the way that the Lunar Housewife story within a story came out, because in the Lunar Housewife, you have Louise's novel, you have a man and a woman who are stuck in a lunar colony. They only have each other to look at or to talk to. They start to feel kind of trapped and restless. And Catherine, the main character in Louise's novel, is essentially, she says, I'm a lunar housekeeper. She keeps their habitat clean. She sanitizes the suit that the man wears when he bounces around on the surface collecting soil samples. And she starts to get really restless and wants to go out on the surface of the moon so badly. She wants to put on the suit. So I thought, I think I was channeling the way a lot of people felt at that time, you know, wanting to go out and do something else or talk to someone else or just have a different experience than bouncing around your own home. So in that sense, it's it's very much a 2020 to now novel, just as it is a 1950. And I don't know how that, I bet that part would have just seemed different if I had written it prior to 2020.
It's interesting that, you know, because this is a question that comes up a lot about the pandemic and whether writers could work through it or, you know, whether it kept writers from working. But, you know, that's another good question about how does it shape your story, you know, to be writing it in a time where you can experience the same emotions and the same boundaries that your characters are.
Yeah. And, you know, as I mentioned, I have two little kids. They weren't in school. We weren't bringing in any babysitters. So it was hard. And I certainly understand any writer who wasn't able to get anything done. I mean, I think I did it out of sheer maternal rage and desire to do something else. And to find a piece of entertainment for myself. You know, it felt really good to put my kids in bed and then be able to return to writing The Lunar Housewife, because I was entertained by it. And I think that's when I really knew, oh, I think this is a good book, because I am enjoying going back into this story every night. I really liked writing it. I didn't like revising it as much. It's always more painful. But while I was writing it, it was kind of a pleasure. So, that's what came out of that time. But I was certainly tired as well.
I'm sure you were. So was it your vision that Louise would finish The Lunar Housewife, that she would actually complete the novel and get it published? How did you feel about that when you were writing it?
I thought she should finish it, and there would have to be, I don't know if I knew exactly what was going to happen the whole time, but I thought she should have some form of a victory, over people who have done her dirty, and also, the censor lot, as she and Hemingway call them. I don't know if I realized right when I started writing it that as circumstances happened to Louise, her story that she was writing was also going to change to reflect that. And I think there was a point at which I thought, oh, I should just, for continuity, I should write The Lunar Housewife first, and then I should write Louise's, her arc. And I decided to just be linear, because it helped with my momentum. But I thought that ended up being the right call, because I would write a couple of chapters of what was going on with Louise and Joe, and then it would be time to return to, okay, it's time for more Lunar Housewife. And I'd think, well, how is she going to write this part after all that just happened with Joe? And I'd think she would be really mad, and she's gonna put that into her book. And then she even comments at one point in the book that she didn't know what it was all going to mean when she started writing. So after she uncovers a whole lot of stuff, and, you know, some things happen, something violent happens, she realizes that things she had written in a more innocent state suddenly take on a new meaning. Which was fun for both me and Louise to figure out at the same time.
So now you've written two novels that are not connected. Are you pursuing a third one? And if so, where are you going with it?
I have three ideas right now. And I think when I was in grad school, Hajin, our teacher, would kind of trained us to do that. We took a novella class with him, and he said, write A, B, and C, and then the class is going to look at those and decide, help you decide. So that's where I am right now. They're all either 1950s again, or late 1880s, which would be a change for me. But they're either set in, as I mentioned, Boston or Chicago, or possibly the Badlands. And yeah, I like sticking with kind of recent historicals that have to do with women and either fertility or taking care of children, or just women's domestic roles and how outside forces, you know, are impressing upon them. With that. So yeah, I'm not sure yet, but I'm probably going to start. I will start writing it in July. And if I can keep the same speed that I did with Lunar Housewife, I could be done with a draft in the fall. That's my hope. I'm actually really excited to get started. something about all of the Lunar Housewife events and press has got me like, okay, I really want to start writing the next one now. So yeah, I mean, stay tuned. I'm sure there will be an update on that soon.
Well, that'll be wonderful. And your children are old enough, you know, to have some sort of daycare, which will help.
Oh,
a lot.
Yeah. They're back in. Yeah. They went back to school this past year and we had a sense of normalcy again. So, and I have a summer babysitter who they love, which always makes you feel good.
Wonderful. Well, sounds like you're primed to do good things. Let's call Patrick up and see if he has any questions or contributions that he would like to make. I love the way he materializes. It's so cool.
Well, I think you've wowed them. I don't see any actual questions that have come in. Let me just check here.
But you always have good questions.
Well, yeah. You touched on this a little bit, but was there anything in particular that particularly fascinated you about this period, the 50s, you know, dialing in on this right now?
Oh, yeah. Well, the notion that those were the good old days, I always like to turn something like that on its head. and, you know, I think I've always thought about the 50s a lot and the conformity that kicked in after World War II, the way that women were sent back into their domestic roles, and really wanted to create a believable heroine in that time period who was thwarting a lot of those expectations. And I know I mentioned Anne Royfe, and she was writing about her life in the early 60s, but the early 60s really weren't that different from the 50s. And she, you know, provided the proof that there were women who were, you know, raising a kid alone and unafraid to have sex and aspiring to be writers. So I thought, okay, I can write about somebody like that. But the challenge, I think, in writing about the 50s was making Louise believable enough. You know, she wasn't going to behave like Madonna or something like that. And yet also make her, give her agency, make her say interesting things. At one point, I think I talked to my agent about a draft and she said, you should give Louise more agency and let her speak up more. And I think I was at a certain point early in the draft, erring on the side of like obedient 50s young woman. And I had to break that habit a little bit.
How about the name Louise?
Oh, it's my grandmother's middle name.
Okay.
My grandmother was, I think she's almost the exact same age as Louise. My grandmother was born in 32 and Louise was born in 29. So I was kind of picturing her sometimes when I was writing Louise. She kind of looked like Grace Kelly and had great style. And so I picture her middle name. And I also, Louise's name is Louise Lighthouser, and Hemingway comments, it sounds like a girl journalist in a comic book. And I did that on purpose. Like I wanted her to be a little unreal, a little like a celebrity already. I don't know why.
I thought that might be a nod to Louise Brooks. Do you know?
Oh yeah, but it could have been. That's a good idea. I don't think I was thinking of Louise Brooks, but yeah.
But that whole underside of the Norman Rockwell facade of America.
Right.
That sort of. There, have you read much Patricia Highsmith by chance?
I have a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, she wrote a great one called Edith's Diary, which was one of her odd kind of slippery, subversive, not series books, but it was about this woman who was caught in just the sort of, you know, claustrophobic world. And she's an artist and a writer herself. Really interesting book, kind of stuck in that time period.
I should read that. Yeah, I was thinking of Patricia Highsmith and other 50s era creators who were really, who were subversive in their own ways, like Rod Serling with the Twilight Zone. And I think it might have gone over a lot of people's heads, but it was really interesting to learn that he wanted to make a show about racism in America, and he was turned down by the network. And so he makes The Twilight Zone and finds a way to be political and subversive through sci-fi. And I know there's a quite a history of sci-fi being on the cutting edge of counterculture, right up to Marvel.
There's a novel there, Carolyn.
Oh yeah, I should. That could be another one. But yeah, I was thinking even like X-Men and what X-Men was able to say about gender nonconformity and race and way before you could really talk about that openly. So that's also a little bit what Louise is trying to do with The Lunar Housewife.
Scooby-Doo too.
Scooby-Doo, yeah. Oh my, I love it.
Analyze that in terms of all the roles too.
My kids watch Scooby-Doo now, I love it.
There's a question, let's see here. What is the name of the writer who you were talking about, who's a single mom in New York? Anne Roife?
Anne Roife, R-O-I-P-H-E. And the book I'm thinking of is Art and Madness, but she certainly has others. And her daughter is Katie Roife, who is also a writer. Art and Madness is really, really interesting.
Were you drawn to writing a book about a writer being a writer? I mean, I find it interesting, you know, when writers make writers the protagonists of their plots.
Well, she had to be a creator whose work could have been targeted by spies. And there was a little bit of time, I think, right in the beginning when I thought, well, should she be a painter? But I think it's harder to and there are certainly good writers who can do it, but it would be harder for me to describe paintings in the novel. And I thought, I like novels within novels. And, you know, I love The Blind Assassin by Margaret Atwood, which has a sci-fi novel in it. So that seemed natural for me to do that. But yeah, I felt a little self-conscious, like, oh, the writer writing about a writer. but it felt more natural than having her be like a visual artist, especially since I'm not a visual artist and I don't know that much about it.
You have to do all that.
There are a lot of terrific novels, you know, writers about writers. Jean Hanf Corlett's The Plot last year, I thought was exceptional. Oh, yeah. You know, there have been a number of really wonderful. I always think it's interesting, you know, because in a way you have to dissect yourself in order to create the character. And, you know, I think that would be an interesting process. Patrick, I cut you off from asking something. I'm sorry. What was it?
It's gone. It's a pretty short window before I can use it. So it's gone.
Already.
I don't remember.
Okay. Well, Carolyn, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Can you hold up your book so everybody can see it? There it is, The Lunar Housewife, which has, if you look, a really interesting cover. The image of the woman on the front is so 1950s, and, you know, I like the lighting and so forth in it. So
it's a galaxy.
Thank you very much for, The Lunar Housewife thing. Yeah, no, it's really great. I wonder, you know, do you think that title will be held if it's published in other countries? Because we started out talking about that.
I don't know. Yeah, that was my original title, and everyone at Penguin Random House seemed to like it, so that was exciting. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if it gets published in other countries if somebody changes it for some reason or another. No.
Well, we'll see. But anyway, now you know why it's called The Lunar Housewife, because that is, in fact, the title of the novel within the novel. So it's very cool. Anyway, what a pleasure to meet you. Stay in touch.
Thank you.
And thank you all very much for joining us this evening. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.